Hey, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, I'm talking with Amy Clement from the University of Miami and the Rosenstiel School, which is one of the four major institutions of oceanography and oceanographic research in the U.S., along with places like Woods Hole and Scripps. Amy and I have been in touch over the years, and as often happens, I finally ran into her at a meeting and invited her to come on the show. And I was thrilled that she did because she's made some advances or proposed some ideas that I found to be just extremely interesting. And in particular, the kind of continual questioning of what's really driving some of the major variability we see in the climate system. For example, what's really controlling the variation in the Southern Oscillation or the Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation? A lot of people have thought or proposed or maybe just assumed that the ocean itself had some kind of a major forcing on those modes of variability. And what Amy has argued and shown in her modeling experiments over the years is, for example, that maybe you really just don't need the ocean variability. Maybe things like the AMO or the Southern Oscillation are just intrinsic parts of the climate system that are produced by the large-scale atmosphere itself for reasons that aren't entirely clear at present, but it doesn't seem like you actually need the oceans, which is deeply fascinating. Amy has also taken on leadership roles now at the University of Miami, and we chat about kind of the challenges you face there by going into something like a deanship without really having training in how to manage people or how to be a dean and how to work in a financially driven organization like a university. We talk about her own mentor, Mark Kane, his influence on her, and then some of the sort of interesting discussions she's had with colleagues about how men and women differ in their own approaches to mentoring. We go to topics like getting into surfing in your early 30s. And finally, Amy has this amazing vision for what she's going to be doing in the future, which is developing a hierarchy of climate models to describe the way that the physical processes really matter or do not matter as you go from single column models up to fully coupled GCMs. So it's a fascinating talk, at least for me, hopefully for you too. In other matters, let's see here, AGU is now long over. I've registered to go to a meeting in Tasmania. It's the IPICS meeting, which is the International Partnerships in Ice Core Sciences. And it's a gathering of everyone who's interested in ice cores, from the people who are doing the coring to doing the modeling, looking at fern compaction, all kinds of super geeky issues, but also big picture science. So I'm really looking forward to that and getting a chance to go down to the CSIRO offices and University of Tasmania and the Australian Antarctic Division while I'm down there. That should be a great trip. And as always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests. Thanks a lot. Amy Clement from the University of Miami and the Rosenstiel School. Amy, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks, Michael.
It's one of those situations where we've been in email contact for, I guess, maybe the past 8 years, but I only met you for the first time at the recent AGE when you were walking past with Pedro D'Anizio, one of your old students, who, on the other hand, I met, I think, a three or four meetings in a row. So it's great to finally get a chance to talk to you a little bit.
Yeah, and it's like I can consider that a success in my career when my students are introducing me to important people.
It must have been somebody else, not me. Who you were born, I suspect, around the same time I was, but you were born in Boston, Massachusetts. So, I went to Boston in the late 80s. My mom was there doing a residency for her psychology degree at the Boston VA hospital. And at the time, I was only there for a little bit, but I love being there. It was a fantastic place to visit when you're an 18-year-old. What were your experiences growing up? But what part of the city did you live in?
I was born in Boston, but I didn't really grow up there. I lived in some formative years in Marblehead, Massachusetts, north of Boston. And then we moved to Long Island in New York when I was 11. So I went to high school. So I really consider myself a New Yorker, if you can't tell.
Did you know my cousins?
Are they from that? Did they go to college at one of the?
They didn't go to college there. So they grew up in Miller Place, which was not far from Port Jefferson. Was that your part of Long Island?
Well, I'm a little bit further, closer to the city.
Okay. So,
but similar, on the north shore of Long Island. I grew up in Huntington, went to Huntington High School, proud alumni, grew up swimming on in Long Island Sound, which is really different from Miami.
A little chillier.
And a little bit murkier.
I read the speech you gave for your 2007 McIlwain Award from AGU. Mark Kane gave you the introduction for that. And it was a short speech, but it was really packed with a lot of information in there. And one thing you said was that you thanked your parents for their high expectations and their support of your interest in science. What were they like as parents? How did they interact with you in terms of your early interest in science?
Oh, that's funny. You should ask that. I was just talking with my parents yesterday about something that came up again with one of my kids related to science. But my dad was an engineer and my mom is a writer. So neither of them were really scientists, although, and you know, engineers are really different from scientists. They might be as different from scientists as writers are. You know, I was always asking weird questions and they thought it was sort of strange. Like the one that my mother just brought up the other day was they brought me to, you know, sit on Santa Claus's lap. I was probably around 6 or 7. I asked Santa Claus to explain what infinity was.
I want an explanation of infinity for Christmas.
Exactly. I was like sort of caught up in the whole magic of Christmas and was figuring this was as close to someone who was all-knowing as I was going to get. So here was my opportunity. So one of my kids is asking some of those same questions, which everybody else thinks is kind of, could be kind of strange, but I think you got the right mom. But yeah. Anyway, that's not exactly what I was referring to. My brother and sister are both very accomplished in very different ways. My brother is an artist in New York City and he does large-scale steel sculpture. My sister is an attorney in San Francisco. Everybody went to Ivy League schools and were really successful. So I think my parents, they weren't attorneys, they weren't artists, and they weren't scientists. So they just said, all right, kids, you got to do something that's important and you love and feel passionate about, and you got to do it well.
So you knew kind of going into it that that was the family expectation. And did you ever have a period of rebelling against that, or did it seem like a good idea from the get-go?
I was always really into science. Like I said, from young age, just wondering why, you know, in middle school was volunteering at labs to clean beakers and stuff. You know, I just wanted to be part of the whole science operation. So I never rebelled against that, my own passion. I'm sure my parents will say I rebelled against them and some other kind of codes of conduct, but it wasn't in the academic world. No rebellion there at all.
Also in that same speech, you said that one of your sons, I think it was Jasper, said that he was going to give you a toy for being a good scientist. What did you get?
You know what? I don't know if I ever held him to that offer.
Oh.
And it's not too late, right? Is there a statute of limitations on that kind of thing?
I would think not. Maybe he's got a surfboard or something like that.
I'm going to ask him about that today. Yeah, bike, surfboard, something like that. He's 12 now, so he has toys that I can play with.
I saw elsewhere that you're a surfer. Was that an early passion of yours in Long Island, or did it develop later?
No, when I moved to Miami, I was really lucky to be introduced to some, let's not call them middle-aged, but like just before middle-aged female surfers who had, well, they had been surfing for a long time and but they were my age, which was around 30 at the time, and they decided I was going to learn to surf. And so I did. But I was a swimmer as a kid, so I was always in the water.
It wasn't a foreign operation for you?
No, it was actually, surfing was a great excuse to spend more time in the water.
Something else that struck me from that 2007 speech you gave was Mark Kane gave the introduction, and then you complimented Mark for his skills in mentoring. And just recently in 2015, you received an award for mentoring. And I'm curious about your experiences, both working with people like Mark and then developing your own sense of what it means to be a good mentor. How has that evolved over the years? And how do you deal with students that you're mentoring who might have just extremely different needs? I mean, some of them need a lot of freedom and some of them need a lot of
I wouldn't call it handholding, but a lot more direction. Some have more technical needs, some have more conceptual needs. How do you approach that whole mix of questions for students and grad students?
Oh, that's a great question and something that's still evolving constantly. But let me go back to say something about Mark, because I just met with him yesterday. I have the great pleasure of now being able to have my former mentor in Miami a couple months a year, because he's, you know, like a snowbird, so he's down here. And he also interacts a lot with my current students. That relationship with him as a mentor is, you know, a lifelong thing, which is what I think what every mentor-mentee relationship can aspire to. And I feel really lucky. I still, just talking with him yesterday during the conversation, feeling so privileged for having been and owe him so much in terms of my career and successes and just life in general even. So how does that influence me as a mentor? Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting gender issues in mentoring that are really different between men and women. And we talk a lot about that at Rosenstiel School. As part of a sort of follow-up to the mentoring award, we are doing a mentoring workshop in a couple weeks where we're bringing in an outside facilitator who's a woman who works, like she's been working in corporate leadership kind of world. And she is going to come in and lead some discussion and skill building exercises on how to develop good communication skills between mentors and mentees. What you mentioned, I think, is really critical is understanding each individual and how their need may be different from either what you have to offer or from other students. And so, you know, as a good mentor, when you see students needing things that you can't provide, you either learn how to provide them or you find somebody else to help.
A co-advisor, for example.
A co-advisor, right. Or what I'm noticing a lot in our field is that students are broader and broader thinkers. And, you know, we're required to be broader thinkers by, for example, National Science Foundation, who expects our research to have broader impacts. And we're really slow to respond in academic world to today's requirements on people as they do their PhDs and then go into their careers.
Do you mean because we're just sort of focused on trying to give them what we got when we were getting our PhDs and not necessarily what the current market demands?
Exactly. And we're really slow on that. And I think we're kind of catching up. But part of that is where I've never been outside of academia. I went right from college to grad school and then right into a job as a postdoc at a university. And now I've never been in the real world. I feel really limited as a mentor for those students that want to end up outside academia.
Probably half of them will end up in a non-academic career.
Exactly.
I went to a mentoring workshop several years ago, and they brought in a quasi-corporate consultant, just like you're doing now. And initially, I thought, oh, this is kind of a ridiculous exercise. But then once they got into it, I found that these very, very simple things that you just accept about yourself without thinking about them are really different from other people. And it's not something we routinely investigate in science education. And I think it's actually the first time that I thought, I'm kind of an introvert. I had never realized that about myself. And then when you at least have it on the plate for something to think about when you're talking to either your students or other students, I know you're now associate dean as well, I think it can be really quite helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. These are all professional skills. They tie to mentoring, but they go beyond that. You mentioned my job as an associate dean. I have no experience managing people, you know, beyond just a mentor-mentee relationship. And yet here I am. And I am part of the university as a business where there are a whole other set of demands on you that I'm not trained for. And so those are also prompted me to be thinking more broadly about training people. Even if they do end up in academia, we can be doing much better in academia where you end up having to do things beyond just research. Those, you know, all come down to good communication skills and good writing skills. And they're all really wrapped up together, I think.
I thought for me, one of the skills I developed probably badly over the years was just empathy and trying to understand where people they're coming from and their decisions, and kind of trying to put yourself into the worst case scenario for how someone's day might be going, and that their reactions to what you're saying and their reactions to what you might be doing may just be a function of the day that they're having, not how they are, what they really feel. Do you have, when you're in a dean, do you have the time to sort of allow for that kind of introspection and letting the process take a little bit more time in terms of how people might be responding?
Well, when you're a dean and you're also doing it on a part-time basis, the answer, do you have time for it, is no. But still, you have to do it, I think. It becomes really inefficient if not taking the time to empathize and see where the other person is coming from, leads you to bad decision making or miscommunication that ends up being even more inefficient. Those are definitely the kind of things that you become more aware of. And in a school like the University of Miami, where they're trying to transform the culture of the place to be more service oriented. So there is a lot of discussion about the sort of corporate culture of the university. And these are the kind of things that they talk about when you're trying to transform the culture of a corporation, I think.
You mentioned that in your experience, men and women have different needs from their mentors. Difficult to generalize, but in your experience, what have been some of those different needs?
There's no doubt that men and women have different needs, but also I think that the mentor, whether the mentor is a man or woman, sets a really different tone for the discussion. When we have a lot of discussions about mentoring, we were having among faculty, there were a couple women and a couple men, and the men were saying, oh, when I have a problem with a student, I'll just go out, drink a beer, and we'll just hash it out. The woman that I was standing with and I looked at each other and we were like, oh my God, I would never do that. That would be the last thing I would do when I was having an issue with a student, would be to go like drink some beers with them. and that was like where the gender dividing line was on that issue was really clear. And I've noticed it's kind of more widespread. I don't know if it's historical or maybe it's personal, but setting up boundaries, those boundaries may be different for men and women.
If the conversation had been the other way around, if there had been a woman speaking and there had been a male faculty member who was being surprised by what they were saying, what would they have been surprised by? What is the first thing that you think a female faculty member might go to instead of going to get a beer and hashing it out?
Okay, well, at the risk of being a little bit stereotypical here, I would say this might be a stretch, but I bet that a male faculty would be surprised by the level of like self-questioning that female mentors go through.
About their own work or about their own mentoring?
All of the above. And in particular, mentoring, you know, I think that's pretty widespread phenomena that's been documented, is that women have this kind of, are more likely to have this imposter complex. That said, I should say that my advisor, Mark Kane's advisor, was Jules Charney, who was probably like the most brilliant person in our field ever, or up there. And he made some comment, I can't remember exactly what it was, to Mark when Mark was his student, about feeling like he was about to be found out every moment.
You mean Charney had imposter syndrome?
That's what Mark once told me. So proven, but you know, it just goes to show, I think, that these things aren't so clear down gender lines.
Moving on to your own career in academia, which as you said was fairly linear, you began in getting your bachelor's in 1993 from Columbia, and then you just stayed for the duration getting your PhD in 1999. And I talked to Robin Bell a little while ago, and she has had a long career at Columbia as well. And there have been a lot of people who have had long-term Columbia associations. And I'm just wondering, why do people love why do people love Lamont so much? Why do they stay for so long? Were you tempted to go to somewhere else to get your PhD?
Why do people love Lamont? Well, I was an undergrad in the physics department. So Lamont was, I moved towards Lamont. Actually, I was doing research there as an undergrad too, in seismology with Bill Menke and Klaus Jacob, and geophysics more generally. Why do people love Lamont? Well, have you been there? It's really beautiful.
I have. And it's an amazing place, I have to say.
It's a beautiful place. There's a culture there, I think, that's really unique. And a lot of it comes from the great minds that are there. Like Wally is pretty much, I think, largely responsible. Wally, and then, you know, he was there before, but then Mark coming there expanded the discussion. But this view of looking at the Earth system, I took a class with Wally when I was a freshman called How to Build a Habitable Planet. And he wrote a book, you may have seen it, but starts with the Big Bang. And it ends with global warming today. And that view of the climate, atmosphere, ocean, Earth system is so broad and so compelling that everybody is just very influenced by that view of things.
So people have kind of bought into the broader institutional vision, even though they might be working on glaciology or aerosols or past climate reconstructions. They're all entranced by that big vision.
Absolutely. I don't know if it's still the case. It was the case when I was there. I gave a talk there in October, and I think it's still very much like when you're thinking about what's happening now, that the big picture, which includes the history of the Earth as a whole, is really germane to those issues. That's my own opinion about why Lamont is so special, because there's that sort of intellectual force that's there. And I don't know if that's what keeps people there, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And it kept me there.
Yeah.
I didn't consider going other places.
After the better part of a decade at Columbia and Lamont, you then went to the University of Paris. And it looks like, just looking at the dates, you might have gone to Paris before you had completed your PhD. Is that correct?
No, I completed my PhD right at the end of 98, probably officially graduated in May. But I was done. I had defended, and like 2 days later, I got on a plane and moved to Paris. Not leaving before we had a giant Halloween party.
Of course. Arriving in Paris, how did you find the intellectual climate there compared to what you've just described at Lamont? Was it similarly broad-based, or were people focused on more narrow pursuits in Paris?
Well, when I arrived there was the congealing of the European Union. There was a lot of pressure for people to be part of really big Europe-wide projects. That was actually ended up being bad for me, because I went there on a fellowship where I basically had my own money. I wasn't part of anyone's project. There were these giant projects happening, and I was just sort of on my own. I went there with the idea of working on this problem about what happened when the Isthmus of Panama closed. What were the climate consequences of that? It took me a while to get people interested. I actually got someone really important interested in that project. I met him at a party I was on a swim team there, and he was at the swim team's party. So we were just happened to be there. And then I started talking about the Isthmus of Panama at the party. He got excited about it, and he was one of the engineers of the ocean model. So he helped me do some experiments that actually didn't lead to a publication, because the government cut the program that was funding me. So I had to leave early.
So your postdoc was just ended kind of midstream then?
Pretty much. We were just starting to get interesting results. I came back to Columbia for a year after that, and it was really hard to keep it going remotely, because the person I was collaborating with, he wasn't really big into email, and there wasn't Skype then.
He just preferred phone calls.
He preferred talking in person at parties. Which is,
there you go.
So we couldn't really do that. So
slight impediment.
Anyway, it wasn't that productive a period of time for me, but it was also hard because my husband, who was then my boyfriend, was living in New York, which is part of the reason why I ended up back at Lamont also.
Let's turn to science a little bit. You mentioned that you had early interest in ocean gateways, but your first paper, I believe, with Arnold Gordon back in 1994 was on the Agulhas Current. And I feel like when you're starting off in your scientific career, you can be working with people and they sort of open a huge range of doors for you, sort of possible doors that you might walk through in terms of a longer term direction of your own research. And of course, this is just after you've gotten into your master's program. But what was it about the Agulhas that interested you for that paper, but that didn't make you want to continue on with that particular topic?
Wow, you really done your homework.
I've read them all.
Right. When I started, Arnold accepted me as a PhD student. I had taken his class on climate as a senior in undergrad. And it was really exciting because he had a station on an ice floe in Antarctica during the semester where he was teaching, and he kept reporting to us where it was, and actually ended up moving equatorward too fast. And so he had to like leave all of a sudden and go help with the rescue mission or, you know, to get everybody off the ice. And at least that's how I remember it. But anyway, I started working with Arnold. I got really fascinated with his view of the climate system from that class. And so I started working with him, and he had just come back from the cruise that collected all this data back in the good old days, but how he describes it, of oceanography, where you get a ship and you get the ship time and you can kind of use it to explore the ocean rather than having to, you know, I think there was just more freedom in terms of the amount of ship time that they had. So they could be creative about the cruise tracks. And so he took the ship and did all these cross sections of these eddies that they found.
The Agulhas rings that are spinning off.
That were in the Atlantic. And so it was really an interesting data set. And one of the things they used was this new instrument, which isn't new anymore, which is the ADCP, which is the Doppler profiler of the currents. And so you could get actual direct measurements of the currents, not have to infer them from geostrophic balance. And so it was a new data set. We had to do all this post-processing to correct for errors and stuff. That was fun, little programming project. You know, we got an answer, and it was part of Arnold's view of the climate system, where this large-scale ocean, global ocean circulation was moving heat and salt around in a way that regulated the climate ultimately. So after doing that paper, I started working a little bit on looking at some more ocean hydrographic data, and I was having trouble with the intellectual leap, which you'll notice this is probably a theme in my research even today, of saying, how does this large-scale ocean circulation relate to what we're seeing at the surface? So I wrapped up that thesis, and at the time, Mark had been at Columbia for about 10 years and was becoming under the influence of Wally and others and starting to think about paleoclimate. You know, he had just done his successful forecast of El Nino and starting to think about whether a giant, persistent La Nina event could cause an ice age. And I remember riding in the car, commuting back into the city from Lamont with Richard Seeger. And he said, oh, Mark has this great idea. It sounds so exciting. So I went and talked to Mark, and he said, well, you want to work on this? And I said, yeah. I ended up switching gears there. So I think it was the same issue that I'm struggling with today, which is the story about the large-scale ocean circulation. I mean, it really came together powerfully at that time at Lamont and GFDL, where Manabe was doing these simulations to show that you can turn on and off the thermohaline circulation. Wally was showing that the deep ocean was really different during glacial climates and then during Heinrich events. And it looked like that you could turn on and off the circulation. And Arnold was documenting what's happening in the modern ocean. So it really was like a powerful synergy of ideas. But I wasn't sold even then.
What's really struck me about your work, which is I think exactly what you're saying, is that you've never been persuaded, it seems like, that the ocean had the kind of impact on the broader climate system that people have been saying, or at least implying that it has. And maybe we can talk about a couple of papers that you've written. The first one we commissioned and what we call an unlinked news and views on in Nature back in, I think it was 2011, but it was your paper in the Journal of Climate, which, if I have this right, you're basically saying that you can have the Southern Oscillation without having the need for a strong oceanic variability component, that it can arise without an oceanic forcing.
Right. Yeah. I still haven't totally answered that. I feel like my life's work is to say there are these kind of preferred modes of variability in the atmosphere, which are tied to some physics. Maybe it has to do with mountain ranges or warm pool, cold tongue, or I haven't quite figured out exactly what they are, but there are these preferred modes of variability in the atmosphere, and they can be tweaked by the ocean circulation, but the large scale structures are there in the atmosphere.
I remember when I first heard the term modes of variability, I had no idea what it meant, but these are just these are things like the Southern Annular Mode or the Pacific Decadal Oscillation or the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. Right. So you're saying that the atmosphere essentially prefers to have these states, and that yes, the oceans do affect perhaps their timing and their magnitude, but they're not intrinsically controlled by the oceanic variability.
You said it better than I could. Exactly.
Turning to your recent paper in Science, I think it came out in October of 2015. I read it and it's extremely interesting because we've published a few papers in Nature, and this is on the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, or the AMO, which is this sort of multidecadal oscillation in North Atlantic sea surface temperatures that are thought to have a major impact on broader climate, particularly in Western Europe. And we had a paper by Ben Booth saying that perhaps the recent cycles were controlled by anthropogenic aerosol variability. And again, in your paper, you're sort of saying, well no, if you run a model where you have either the realistic ocean heat transport or you've cut off that ocean heat transport and you sort of just run a slab ocean model, you can get the AMO without having to have any recourse to variability in the AMOC, sort of that part of the ocean circulation. Is that a fair encapsulation of the results?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I gather it's been controversial, or you've had a lot of feedback on the paper already. What is the feedback you're getting? If people say that this is not the full picture, what arguments do they bring to bear?
Well, that relates to some of the papers you mentioned that you published in Nature. There are other places also, but that I think the biggest criticism is that there is evidence that the ocean circulation, not necessarily the AMOC, but call it the ocean circulation now, plays a role in variability in the high latitude North Atlantic. I don't know what those ocean mechanisms are, but I think the McCarthy's paper is kind of a nice illustration of the fact that the wind can drive an ocean circulation, which will, with some lag, impact the heat content of the subpolar gyre. That's not included in the slab models. In a way, it's not necessarily criticism of what we did, because we do actually say that there's, you know, potential role for the ocean circulation in that region, but it is not required to produce an AMO. So the AMO is not the subpolar gyre heat content. And I think that a lot of papers are kind of unclear, let's say, or it's not clear in the literature that these two things are really distinct. The AMO is obviously an artificial index. You know, there's some probably historical reasons why it came about. It's wrapping up a lot of different things, all of which may add up to a warmer North Atlantic Ocean from the equator all the way up to 60 degrees. The particular mechanisms in any region of the ocean, there can be ocean influences, but that's not the AMO. And so that's where I think the biggest discussions have been happening, and well, don't see eye to eye yet with some of the people that have been criticizing the paper. I don't think we have resolved it in a way to move forward is what is the connection between that region and the large scale AMO. And one of my co-authors, Bjorn Stevens, said it best when we've been discussing some of these comments that we got back on the paper. Is it the tail or is it the dog?
That sounds like Bjorn, yeah.
So is the subpolar gyre dragging the whole North Atlantic around, or is it a larger scale phenomena, which is just the subpolar gyre is just the tail of it, which is where you are getting a little bit of influence from the ocean, but it's just the tail. So I think that's the best way of saying it.
And is that impossible to figure out? I mean, I would think you could look at that with leads and lags in the system, but I guess also that the observational record isn't long enough or dense enough to disentangle that at this point.
Yeah, I think that's the case. It's just we don't have enough realizations. The data is noisy. There's a lot of autocorrelation. I think to first order looks like, in my opinion, and this is a little bit arm-waving, but the null hypothesis is that everything kind of co-varies. And that leads and lags, in order to demonstrate that they're robust and real and physical, it's a tall order when you are looking at, you know, noisy data that is heavily smoothed. We don't have enough realizations of the swings in the AMO to really get at that.
I think it's hard because, like you've been just suggesting, is that these systems are all functioning together and that if you go far enough back in a lag system, they can actually become part of a lead. It's almost like the political spectrum of Republicans and Democrats. And then at some point, they'll become a libertarian.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I think that that's part of it, too. And then we also just haven't been that careful, I think, in what are the consequences of filtering the data and then looking at leads and lags. Honestly, I'm getting into a little bit of arm waving here because I haven't done it. Been careful myself about that. That's part of the reason why the beauty of the approach that we took is that you don't have to infer causality with the slab model because there is no ocean. It still is a little bit of a mystery of why the slab models and the coupled models look so similar.
Yeah, I was really confused by that. I just didn't understand why that could take place.
Yeah, and I think ultimately it's because that the large-scale atmosphere is organizing everything. So whether the ocean is pumping the heat into the region or whether it's coming through the surface fluxes and the wind-driven part of the surface fluxes, I think either way, it's that large-scale pattern that is organizing the system.
Have you tried running the same experiments in an LGM boundary condition?
Oh, funny you should ask that. One, we just got this really interesting result, which is that you get a lot more AMO variability in a glacial slab model than you do
a glacial slab ocean.
Glacial slab ocean than today. And one of the things that we included was dust. So this gets back to the Booth paper, which, by the way, was what set us off on. I hadn't been working on Atlantic climate variability until I read that paper. And I got so excited about that paper because I was like, oh, wow, you can drive the AMO with surface fluxes, which made perfect sense to me. And so that's how we got started looking at this. In fact, we started looking at it from the perspective of cloud feedbacks. So what Booth showed was that the cloud signal is aerosols are amplified through their effects on cloud properties. And so we were looking in cloud observations to see if there is any signature of that in the real world. And it turns out, I just finished providing comments on my former student who has a paper that's showing that there are cloud signals in the surface-based cloud observations that go back to 1954 that look just like the ones in the satellite era that show that you get that Booth-like pattern in cloud fraction that goes with the AMO. That's how we started with this AMO paper, and now we're coming back to it finally. What I think is the overall theme and how this might relate to the LGM and dust is that there's this mode of variability that is in the slab model. It's very robust. All models do this AMO-like thing. And it's tied to the large-scale atmospheric circulation variability. Then when you start throwing things into the atmosphere, like dust or air, or anthropogenic aerosols, that can amplify that mode of variability, whether you amp up the signal through aerosol indirect effects or whether you are just amplify it through the same mechanisms that are in the slab model, that it's a preferred mode of variability and there are lots of ways of exciting it.
So it may not even matter exactly what the process is that's causing this exudation. It could be peak dust production at the LGM, or it could be anthropogenic aerosols, but either one of them could be sufficient to generate this increase in the amplitude.
Right. Or it could be ocean circulation. You know, maybe that's the point that might be being lost a little bit, even in my head, about this debate about the AMOC or non-AMOC, is that this is a mode of variability that's robust and there are different ways to excite it.
You've also done work with aquaplanet models. And as you mentioned, you've done work on slab ocean models, both of which are an idealization of how the real system works. So when I look at the kind of work that you've done, it's been a lot of it on modern dynamics and in the paleo record. But unless I've missed it, you haven't had a strong focus on looking at projections of a future climate. And then if I think about your interest in slab models and aquaplanet models and the paleo work, it seems like you're more interested in the processes that are at work and how the system functions, and perhaps less so in how the system is going to look in the future. Is that the case, or is that actually the projections a strong area of interest for you?
I would say my major focus is on climate dynamics. And so the past is one way of examining, you know, how the mechanisms of climate variability. The future is another way. Present observed variability is another way of looking at it. And so I'm not interested in the future climate change projections. Pedro, most of his thesis, well, about half of his thesis was about anthropogenic climate change and the projections of ENSO. And I just see it as part of this like bigger picture of how the climate system varies, what causes it to vary. And I guess the details of what things are actually going to look like in 50 years is only interesting to me. Well, shouldn't say it's interesting because it's an important problem for society as a whole. But I think from an academic point of view, that the mechanisms that get us there are where my true interests are.
One topic, of course, that's been at the forefront of people's thinking in terms of both mechanism and future projections is the El Nino system. And I talked to Matt Collins a while ago, and I think he mentioned at one point that it seemed like every big El Nino spawned a new theory for El Nino. And of course, your advisor, Mark Keane, had one of the early ideas for how the system worked. And then subsequent El Ninos were following some kind of a different pattern. What is your take on the difficulty that the field as a whole has had? Maybe I'm exaggerating, but sort of the ongoing challenges in developing a conceptual model for El Nino variability that is sufficient to explain the full range of what we have in the observational record.
I mean, I think we're pretty darn good at predicting an individual El Nino event. Even the details of the structure are pretty much there. I mean, I'm satisfied with that as a scientific problem. In other words, I don't have a burning need to dive into the science questions about why one El Nino will look in its detail different from another. The thing that really still we haven't made any progress on, or very little progress on, I think, is the relationship between El Nino and the longer-term context. So an El Nino is an event that has a beginning, sort of a beginning and an end, but it's part of low-frequency variability in the Pacific, which has no explanation right now. It's not clear even what the connection is between El Nino and that low frequency variability. There are people, you know, who argue that there's, you know, El Nino can trigger a response that lingers, producing, you know, sort of a decadal variability in itself. And the burning questions for me are, how does the El Nino phenomena fit into a broader context of climate variability in the Pacific? I mean, after all, Pacific variability, and El Nino happens and then it goes away, but then there are persistent changes in the Pacific have really dramatic impacts. Drought over North America or changes in the fisheries that seem to happen, you know, on a more of a decadal time scale.
There's something going on either in the tropical Pacific or elsewhere in terms of a low frequency drift in the mean state that is potentially somehow affecting the manifestation of El Nino in any particular year. But that connection sounds like it's is remaining completely unclear right
that, now. Or even vice versa. How are these, how does a, what happens, you know, big shock like we're experiencing this year to the system, what are the residual effects that might last a decade? I mean, Pedro has some nice work looking at these multi-year La Niñas. So he's predicting, he probably told you this, so they're after a big El Niño, you should have a La Niña because you get this rebound. And then sometimes the La Niñas last, often they last for multiple years. And what is that kind of long-term ringing from El Niño? How does that influence the decadal variability that we know has impacts?
One of the major pieces of evidence we have for past variation in the El Niño system, of course, is the paleoarchive from things like speleothems or from the coral evidence that people like Kim Cobb and Larry Edwards have been generating over the years. You're clearly a modeler, but you also work with the paleo community. And when you're trying to understand how their data fit in with your modeling, I can imagine that it's difficult to really understand how to use those data because there's a process of continual reinterpretation of the, for example, the Delta 018 that's coming out of those proxies and trying to understand to what degree it does or does not represent local precipitation variability as opposed to, you know, changes in transport distance or source moisture terms and things like that. When you work with paleo data and the paleo community, how do you try and incorporate that sort of shifting understanding into how you use those data?
That's a good question. I mean, I have had papers where we're using the data really directly. So, for example, we had a paper with Richard Seeger and Rob Bergman and others where we actually used coral reconstructions of medieval surface temperature variability to actually run a model and see what the medieval climate would look like, both in terms of its mean and its variability. You know, I've also used the paleo data in the most general way, like looking at how abruptly the climate changes, where you don't end up looking at too much of the details, knowing that they're going to change a lot.
You're looking at the big signals.
The big signals, and what are the ones that pass the smell test to say, okay, there's something there. I mean, I always feel like I am always ending up taking a step back and saying, is there a big picture that's emerging from this? We're working right now, have a bunch of projects lately looking at dust in the climate system and also using proxies of dust deposition and from different types of archives. We have a paper that we're looking right now at a peat record from Iran where we're looking at comparing the Holocene variability and dust deposition to simulations that we have with the model. I really enjoy so much the interaction with geochemists or paleoceanographers, or it's such an interesting process where you have someone like my colleague here, Ali Porman, who's at the Rosenstiel School and working with his student and my research scientists that work with me. And we sit down together and we don't speak the same language at all. And it's so much fun to be able to say, okay, well, they're seeing, you know, looking at some rare earth elements that I can't even pronounce. And we're looking at the position of the mid-latitude jet at 200 millibars in the atmosphere. And somehow, you know, that process of coming together and saying, what's the story here? It's so much fun.
It is. Isn't it?
This is not a very good answer to your question.
That's a great answer.
The process of people coming at the problem from two such different directions with all the baggage of all that I've studied and learned and they've studied and learned, and then trying to emerge with something that is satisfying to me. Like, I'm not going to be satisfied by you telling me something about a wiggle at a particular time period at one particular site that doesn't appear to be connected to anything else. And I'm only going to be satisfied if I can relate it to some kind of large-scale mechanism that is interesting to me. And that's, I guess, the process that kind of, I think, leads to the real science advances.
The paleo community, I mean, you need them to try and tell you what are the real big signals that exist across multiple archives and how to interpret them. And then they perhaps need you to explain the broader scale mechanisms, and only by bringing this together are we ever going to make sense of what really happened.
Right. And the other thing is, are you able to get excited about that mechanism because it's important? I can think of an example. I wrote with Andrew Baker, who's a choral physiologist at Rosenstiel School. So what we were looking at was, he was interested in bleaching events, and because he's looking at recombinations of algal symbionts after bleaching events and seeing whether corals become are adapting to higher temperatures and that kind of thing. And so he's really interested in understanding where are going to be the regions of maximum warming versus minimum warming. That alone, like projecting some specific regional pattern, like as a science question, is not that interesting to me. But it's interesting when it's tied to a mechanism that I think is important and robust. And the patterns that come out of coupled models when you run them with 2x CO2 or, you know, increased greenhouse gases, you get these regions of minimum warming in the tropics and subtropics, which Changping Shi has written about, and we had an earlier paper on that looking in the Atlantic. And the reason why those are a minimum warming is interesting from a climate dynamics point of view, because it's so robust and it ties to a relatively simple but interesting phenomenon, which is that regions of high evaporation have a minimum amount of warming. And then there are feedbacks that go with that, potentially like in the Southeast Pacific, where cloud cover seems to go up with minimum warming. And then that was just an example where sort of a basic question about like, how much is it going to warm over the Great Barrier Reef or over Hawaii, tie to really, I think, important big climate dynamics questions. I'm giving that as an example of the, you know, that can be extended to the paleoclimate. You may still only have one record, but if it happens to be in a region that we can, where it can tell us something about a mechanism that's important on a large scale, then I'm interested.
Turning towards the future, are you going to be working mostly on these kind of dust questions, or are there other topics that you see yourself going for over the next, say, 5 years?
Yeah. So, well, the dust is definitely a part of it. And I have a woman that's worked with me, Lisa Murphy, who's a research scientist, and she's doing tons of interesting stuff. It's just really wide open, I think, about the role of dust in the climate system. And the paleo piece is really important because it's like some really compelling examples of when dust concentrations have been so different from today in a way that is, it's important. My big theme, research theme moving forward, is understanding, I'm trying to put together a picture of the climate system as a hierarchy of climate physics. So this is where some of the aquaplanet work is coming in, and to say, you know, I think the field has been going in the direction of, you know, developing models that are increasing in complexity and resolution and processes, and that's all very good in the service of projecting future climate change, but they're not very good tools for understanding how the climate system works.
Because they're so complicated.
And hard to run for people unless you're at a, you know, a national center where you have basically unlimited computer time. And also just in terms of understanding, you have this incredibly complex machine with millions of degrees of freedom. And so how can you know what were the important processes, or how were those processes influenced as by this increasing complexity? And so what I have been working on lately, and I am working with people at NCAR and also Lorenzo Povani at Columbia, and is trying to set up a hierarchy of the NCAR or Earth system model that spans like the most complete model with all its bells and whistles down to even the simplest like single column version of the model. And then in between, there's a whole range of components, or let's say versions of the model with different complexity. And then the sort of big picture question is, how do the things that we're interested in, whatever they are, whether it's large scale modes of climate variability or the hydrologic cycle or extremes in precipitation, or how do the features of the simulation of those things change as you either strip out physics or include physics? And you can see that's kind of a theme in my research, but what I'm hoping to do is to build a more complete picture of the climate system as a whole, starting from the simplest and building to the most complex, what do you gain in terms of understanding of climate dynamics as you include different levels of physics?
That sounds like a pretty non-trivial task. One that would extend well beyond the normal duration of a 3 or 5 year grant. Are you going to have to form partnerships with institutions that have sort of more long-term hard funding, or are you just going to kind of keep at it over the years and make it work?
Well, what I'm hoping to do is crowdsource it. No, that's not a really good way. I mean, I'm not really. There's a lot of people that think about the climate system in that way also.
From this hierarchy, your processes and models.
Exactly. And what I'm hoping, and I already starting to see that happen, is that people get on board with building components of that hierarchy that will hopefully be available to the community. And that's the tricky part that I still haven't quite figured out, but we've gotten some support from NSF for parts of that, is to say, are there individuals working on whatever their different part, can we all kind of contribute to a collection of models that are usable by other people that can serve the community?
I guess from a completely geeky point of view, you have to maintain some kind of control on this, because if you have a community approach where the different flavors of the model are run in different locations, you have the very strong possibility that the results would be influenced by compiler and machine architecture differences. Are you going to have to sort of run it all at NCAR, even though they're perhaps developed elsewhere?
I don't think so. Although you're right that, you know, the software engineering part of things is, you know, I mean, it's so amazing that we have professional engineers at NCAR that can engineer code that is portable and all that stuff, but there's only so much that they can do. So you're right that there's I don't know how well coordinated it can be. There are pieces of it that can be, like, for example, we've identified with some community input, Lorenzo Polvani and I have identified with some community input, some pieces of the hierarchy. One is the aquaplanet, another is a dry dynamical core, and another is a single column version of the CAM model. So there are pieces of it they're going to be part of the next CESM release. So those will be like really, they won't suffer from the issues that you just mentioned. Then where do we go from there? How do we see, I've already had discussions with people about other elements of the hierarchy. How do we make sure that when people develop those, that they don't just sit on a shelf, or they can be used more widely. So every time somebody else wants to do it, they don't have to reinvent the wheel. I don't know what that's going to end up being like, but I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot of community support for pooling resources to do that kind of thing.
I think there has to be.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Amy Clement is trying to make sense of a complicated system. Amy, thanks a lot for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Amy Clement from the University of Miami. I hope you're enjoying the show. And if you're interested in having other people, colleagues, family, friends, casual acquaintances, your postman, whoever it might be, listen to the show or find the show, the best way to do that is to leave a review if you'd like to. Comments are great on iTunes. That's super helpful in helping the show get more visibility and letting other people find it in their searches. You can also find show notes at forecastpod.org. And feel free to email me at forecastpod@gmail.com. The podcast is also available on Stitcher as well as iTunes. Talk to you soon.